You get what you pay for. Efficient, high-quality service from Perfect Painting and Decorating. In business under the same name since 1975, Perfect Painting and Decorating supplies superior service for both interior and exterior painting, decorative finishing, wallpapering, plastering, drywall and taping, and wood refinishing. For your decorating needs, Perfect Painting and Decorating can custom tint right on the job site. Imagine no interruptions, thorough preparation, professional tradesmen, top-of-the-line materials, meticulous cleanup. Get the job done right the first time. It may cost a bit more for quality, but it's worth it. For a free estimate, call Perfect Painting and Decorating at 847-426-1974. That's 847-426-1974. You'll be glad you did.
I consider trial by jury as the only anchor yet imagined by man by which a government can be held to the principles of its Constitution. So said Thomas Jefferson. What does this mean? Nothing less than that a juror has more power in a particular case than a judge, congressman, or president, and can judge the law. A juror has the right and power to nullify unjust law by voting not guilty, contrary to the jury instructions that many judges routinely give that jurors must apply the law as given by the judge. This is a very important check on the power of oppressive government. In the past, jury nullification has asserted its historical importance concerning fugitive slave laws of the 1850s, prohibition in the 1920s, and draft cases in the 1960s. Oppressive gun laws, tax laws, and drug laws are other instances where the people through its jury said no to government. For more information, call the Illinois Fully Informed Jury Association at 847-426-1974. That's 847-426-1974.
Are you politically homeless? Are you tired of being taxed and regulated by the Democrats? Or regulated and taxed by the Republicans? Would you like to pursue your own dreams without the interference of government? Well, then America's most successful upcoming party, the Libertarian Party, is your political home. The Fox Valley Libertarian Party is your local libertarian group working hard to restore the freedoms of our country once held dear. Yes, you can fight City Hall and win. We did. Find out how. With your help, we will make the 21st century the century of liberty for all. We hold monthly meetings at Diamond Jim's Gas Grill, 325 Meyer Avenue in East Dundee, at the corner of Meyer and Barrington Avenues, on the last Wednesday of every month at 7 p.m. Call 847-426-1974 for more information. That's 847-426-1974. Eternal vigilance is the price of liberty.
Hey, how you doing? This is Joe Walsh. I'm speaking on behalf of Rad. It's okay to rock and roll, right? But don't drive home drunk. If you're drunk, call me up. I have a limo. I'll come and get you.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
The following paid program is sponsored by Prairie Fire Communications. Opinions expressed do not necessarily represent those of staff and management of WRMN Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Freedom Rings. I'm your host, Kenneth John. With me is my excellent producer, Mike. How you doing?
Doing fine. How are you?
Doing fine. Well, boy, this heat just continues.
Yeah, you thought you got a little reprieve from it, and now it's back up in the upper 90s.
I figured, okay, we had our 100-degree spurt. That's it for the year, right?
Now it's gone. No.
Now it's coming back.
It is coming back.
We're very close to it. Wow. What do you know?
I'm getting concerned.
It's devastating to the economy, you know, with the farm prices are going to skyrocket.
Of course. although I never understood, kind of maybe you could enlighten me as you do all the time around here. I never understood if you've got a crop of corn and the corn goes away before a drought or a famine or something, or floods, if something happens, how is it you throw money at it and all of a sudden everything's good? I mean, I'm worried because there's not enough food for the world to eat. There'd be a lack of food. Let's say the state of Illinois has 20% crops. What are you going to do to feed those people when you don't have the crops? You throw money at the deal? I understand the farmers get money to help.
Oh, you mean you're talking about the federal government paying people not to grow?
No, I'm talking about if you have a crop of corn that feeds 50 people.
Right.
And that crop of corn goes away because of some sort of devastation.
Okay.
What happens to those 50 people who need that food?
Well,
I'm worried about the supply of food going away.
Right, right. Well, it's hopefully there's other areas in the world that'll pick up the slack that aren't having the kind of drought that we're having.
So again, throw money at it, and it's going to be okay.
Well, I'm not quite sure how you mean throw money at it.
Well, what else? 50 people that don't have the food now they get money from someplace farther away that costs more money to get them.
Oh, it's going to cost more money. That's just a redistribution, a little bit.
Yeah, it concerns me.
Well, it's—I mean, I think the drought is reason for concern. And it feeds on itself. That's the problem. Once you get it, start getting it, it's like everything's so dry that even when you get with the hot weather, you get the cloud buildup,
yeah,
thunderstorms.
Yeah. The humidity,
but
yeah.
You get a little bit of buildup, and then it hits this real dry earth, and I think it just all dissipates.
So weathermen say, "Why isn't it raining? Because the earth is too dry. Why is the earth so dry? Because it hasn't been raining.
It's
the cycle."
It's a cycle. It's a vicious cycle. Exactly.
Yeah, I'm not happy about it.
No, I don't think not many people are.
Okay.
Landscapers, I'm sure, aren't.
No one's cutting grass.
Yeah, right.
No one's cutting grass.
So, yeah, it's rough. It's rough
boy.
Out there. All right, let's move on to the stupid and or outrageous regulation of the week. And this one involves another dancing violation.
What?
It's a couple... by the name of Carla Stern and George Hess, were dancing on a New York train platform where there were like three people there. Somebody was there on the bongo drums or something like that.
Okay.
And they started dancing to the bongo drums. And there was a cop there, and they got arrested.
No way.
For dancing.
What's the charge?
There's no dancing on platforms.
What?
No, I mean, no. Actually, they're harassing the people. The cop was harassing these two people, telling them they can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So the guy started videoing, whatever, with his phone.
Right, right.
And that's when the cop really got upset. So he called the ninja squad or whatever, you know.
They get really upset when you get them on video, don't they?
Yeah, they don't like that. They don't like accountability. They do not like accountability. So like nine cops descended on this couple, and they arrest them for, let's see, resisting arrest and disturbing the peace or something like that. Disturbing the peace because they're impeding, something like about impeding the flow of traffic, of pedestrian traffic.
Okay.
There were only three people on the big platform. There was like nobody there. But they had to get in with something, so that's what they called it. And I guess resisting arrest because they were using a phone.
Really?
No dancing. Don't be dancing in America.
Remember how
we laughed? Trouble.
Remember how we laughed at Footloose when it first came out? It says, that's ridiculous.
And yeah, there you go. And it's like
uh-huh.
Portending. Isn't that amazing? Yeah, you laugh at like, oh, this is just some Baptist Hicks out, you know, and in the Corn Belt somewhere.
This is downtown New York.
Downtown New York. Arrested for dancing. Isn't that amazing? Well, so that is what can't you be arrested for? That's a question I have. And I often have stated that unless you're violating at least one law per hour, you're probably not really living. So,
If unless you violated one law per hour.
That's my rule.
Not living.
If you're not, you're not really living a real true life if you aren't violating at least one rule per hour, law
now,
per hour.
Is this a worldwide quote or is this a United States of America
I'm referring basically to the United States of America.
Okay.
We got enough laws to fill the whole world,
of
I think.
Of course we do.
Even though this is the land of the free. That's what really gets to me is how people have this illusion that we, that USA, like we're something to be proud of that we're so free. People are blind. We are not free. God, it's a police state. It's an absolute police state, folks. Although I have to say, I'll mention one more thing before we get to our guest. There's this one pastor out west, I forget, in Arizona, who, he got stopped three times within a 90-minute period by a border control, U.S. Customs.
Oh, yeah?
You know, they have these roadblocks out west.
Yeah.
He was stopped three times. So what he's finally been doing, he's been refusing to answer the questions. He says, I'm an American. I don't have to answer your questions.
Hmm.
And evidently, well, one time he did that, he got tased.
Right? He got tased?
Yeah, yes. That was a year or two ago, I think I remember. As of late, evidently, what he's saying is that when he persists and exerts his, I guess, constitutional rights, they let him on his way now. So I guess the rule is, the moral of the story is maybe you don't have to answer these questions when they're asked of you. Now, I'm not saying I recommend it. I mean,
well, yeah.
It might be life-changing. Who knows? But
you do have the right to remain silent.
Well, that's the point.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a Fifth Amendment right in this country,
yeah,
you don't have to answer the questions. So, I don't know. There you have it. All right. We do have a guest.
Yeah, we do have a guest.
Are you executive director of Judith McCreary? Executive director of the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance. And I watched that great documentary a couple weeks ago called Farmageddon. And you were on there, so that kind of piqued our interest. It's amazing to me all the regulations that family farmers have to go through in this country. You'd like to think of that, you have some chickens, you go to the local farmer's market on Saturday and sell your eggs or sell your milk and everything would be cool. But it's like they make you go through a few hoops now in this land of the free, don't they?
It's really shocking when you get into it to realize how much regulation there is of small-scale food production. In general rule of thumb, varies state to state, the details, but the general rule of thumb is, if you're selling uncut fruits and vegetables, you reach up, you pick it off the vine, you hand it to someone, there's probably not a whole lot of regulation. You cut a slice off that peach, you do farm eggs, you make some jams, you bake some bread, whatever it is, and all of a sudden there is just an astounding amount of regulation.
Oh, heaven forbid you put milk or eggs in a cookie or bread or something like that, right? And then
we actually did have, it's interesting. There's a whole movement now in the country. I think we're up to maybe 25 states that have what's called cottage food laws, where if it's a low-risk food, such as a baked good,
mm-hmm.
Cakes, baked pies, things like that, and you're selling direct to consumers. And again, different states have different limitations on it. But basically, it sort of carves out a niche for sort of small-scale, low-risk food sales direct to consumers out of regulation or reduced regulation.
Mm-hmm.
And here in Texas, there's been a huge amount of opposition from local health departments, and we actually had recently a local health department tell a baker that because the cottage foods bill covered non-potentially hazardous foods, she couldn't put eggs or milk into the cake batter.
How the heck are you supposed to make cake without eggs?
Yes, it was fairly shocking. I wrote a letter to his supervisor and said the non-potentially hazardous part applies to the finished product. That the cake is a non-potentially hazardous food. It's well understood that you put often ingredients
Maybe Monsanto makes some kind of fake egg stuff you can add.
Who knows? And the fascinating thing is the response from them so far was basically, well, we're trying to understand the law. I'm like, really? How hard is it to understand that baked goods are allowed and people use eggs and milk in baked goods? Is that really that complicated?
I mean, even if, I mean, it might not taste good, but even if I would think the eggs were not, you know, were spoiled or whatever, if you're baking it for 45 minutes in a 350-degree oven, is there even any risk involved?
If they were actually spoiled, there could be, you know, you wouldn't have any live bacteria left, but you'd have the byproducts. I mean, I really would not suggest using spoiled eggs.
I'm not recommending. I'm just thinking of how absurd the regulations are, though.
But wouldn't it transmit salmonella or E. coli, for instance? I mean, there is that. I mean, it's, yeah, once you've baked it at 350 degrees for half an hour or an hour, depending on your recipe, you know, the bacteria are dead.
Yeah. You would think so. You would think so. I don't know. So anyway, you had this organization that's advocating for the small farmer, small rancher. And I want to backtrack a little bit. You mentioned Texas is really tough on these local health regulators. See, this is something I would expect in Illinois. Actually, some of us in Illinois have this vision that Texas, you're relatively free down there.
You know, I have to admit, I lived in this little fantasy world. I grew up in Texas. I'm a native Texan. I lived in this fantasy world of Texas being this, you know, libertarian-oriented, sort of very independent, pro-small business state.
Right.
And then I got into food issues.
Oh, boy.
It's really pretty amazing how hostile our health authorities are to small-scale local food businesses.
Oh, I understand it now. See, everything in Texas is big, right?
Apparently,
so we have to have big agribusiness and big regulators.
We have a huge number of small-scale independent producers still, but yes, we have a huge amount of agribusiness. And I'll tell you, to a large extent, you know, we're whittling away at it. But they call a lot of shots around this state and all over the country. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, Texas is unfortunately reflective in a lot of ways of the rest of the country.
Well, you're not as bad as, let's say, Wisconsin as far as raw milk is concerned. And raw milk, I don't think even pets can give your pets raw milk or whatever.
On raw milk specifically, we do have better laws than Wisconsin. There's a whole range, again, all over the country. And Texas is one of sort of the middling states. I don't remember offhand Illinois, but, you know, there's about a dozen states that allow on-farm sales with permits. So you have to get licensed by the state, and then you can sell it, but consumers have to come to the farm. And I think that's about 10 or 12 states, and Texas is one of those.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You have states where you can't, you know, no raw milk is allowed at all. Wisconsin's one of the hardest. And then you've got, you know, half a dozen or more states where it's legal on the grocery store shelves. You know, Connecticut and California, you can walk into a grocery store and get raw milk.
Oh, amazing. That's great. Wow.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Correct me if I'm wrong. It seems to me what's happening is the food industry and agribusiness have gotten so big and have, let's be honest, they, with economies of scale, they've really reduced the price of food, I would say, over time. But what happens, I guess, when you get that big, it's probably hard to, I'd say harder maybe to control, maybe some contamination issues. Versus if you stayed small. What I'm getting at is I'm wondering if they protect themselves. So this is what usually happens, is it's a revolving door thing with the regulators and big corporate business, is that they actually ask for the regulations and to everybody to protect themselves, to protect their bigness, because they need the regulations to almost justify their, you know, the fact that possibly they could be contaminating some food. I don't know. Whereas if you're small, you can control that sort of thing.
You've tied up a lot of concepts all in one in that. I mean, that's one big package. And there are a lot of layers. I mean, agribusiness, food is cheaper from agribusiness. There's no question that food is cheaper. But first of all, we pay a lot for it in ways we don't know. We pay a lot for it through government subsidies.
Right.
We pay a lot for it through damage to the environment and unfair wages for workers and, you know, picking up illegal immigration. I mean, actually, you know, there's a whole other topic about the ties between agribusiness and illegal immigration. So, you know, there are huge costs that we simply pay in other areas, not in our grocery store bill, and so we don't realize they're linked, and in our own health. And then what you get is very much a revolving door that you mentioned, where you see over and over agribusiness players going into the USDA and the FDA, USDA and FDA employees, and for that matter, you know, often congressional staffers going and getting nice paying jobs at agribusiness and going back and forth between them. And agribusiness loves, frankly, regulation. It's interesting. As much as they yell about you know, free business and reducing regulation, there's certain regulations that they love.
Mm-hmm.
And they love regulations, first of all, that give them cover, that
right.
helps them greenwash.
Exactly.
So it convinces people that they're doing things, because they get to say, well, we're complying with, you know, the Food Safety Modernization Act. We're complying with all of the USDA regulations. We're complying with this. Your food is safe. And it gets people to stop thinking about the reality and creates this political cover for them. And, of course, in the meantime as well, many of those same regulations, they insist on being applied to small farmers, and that drives small farmers, who are their competition, and the alternative for people to wake up and realize that all food is not created equal, it drives them out of business. And so, for instance, on the Food Safety Modernization Act, which was mentioned briefly in Farmageddon, it was fascinating to watch. Industry supported the Food Safety Modernization Act. They wanted new food safety regulations from the FDA. Absolutely strong support across multiple sectors of the industry. Supported it. We, after a very strong fight, as a coalition of organizations, got in the Tester-Hagen Amendment that exempted small-scale direct marketing producers from new FDA regulations. Now, keep in mind, it doesn't exempt them from all regulation. They're still local, state, existing FDA regulation. I mean, it's not like the small-scale producers somehow all of a sudden were running free. They just weren't going to have to hit this new level of regulation. And all of a sudden, quite a few, some major industry players, turned around and tried killing the entire bill rather than have it pass with the Tester-Hagen Amendment.
Yeah, we can't have that 2% competition answer or whatever it is.
No. And they were very angry. It was a fascinating dynamic watching the debate and the language of the debate and seeing it, because it ended up being phrased in what I really think was the truth, which is our side saying all food is not created equal. It is different. If you are a small-scale business who's responsible to your community, you're living in the community you're selling to, you're looking your customers in the eye, that's different. Food is not food. You know, things are different. And and that principle is what the other side hated. They did not want Congress to recognize that principle officially.
And a little earlier, you hit on what I think is really key here, is that the point of getting corporations getting cover through the regulations, through the bureaucracies, because they're complying. They're complying with these very strict regulations. What do you want me to do? It reminds me, decades ago, I think it is by now, the state of Illinois sued the city of Milwaukee for polluting Lake Michigan. And Milwaukee went to court with a motion to dismiss, stating that they were polluting within the EPA guidelines of how much they could pollute. And they got the case dismissed.
Yeah.
Whereas if you had a libertarian-style a common law court system, if there's a tort, if there's a harm done, you have standing in court. And you can solve the problem. So what happens here, and it's really more strict than the regulations, because if there's harm proven, if 12 jurors decide there's harm proven, then you know, there's compensation. But in this modern system of regulatory government, if the agribusiness, you know, harms somebody, but they did it within their own FDA regulations or whatever, well, where are you? Where, you know?
And we see it over and over. I mean, and that's, we see it in the realm of food safety. We see it, you know, the interesting thing, we started looking into freedom to farm laws. And there's a lot of intuitive appeal for particularly libertarians in freedom to farm laws. And there's a lot of appeal for those of us who are farming, because a lot of you often will see the situation. You know, somebody's out in a slightly rural area but not too far away from a city, mm-hmm. and some city folks come, move next door because they want to live in the country, and then they decide, but we don't like the sound of roosters crowing, and we don't like the smell of the cows, and we don't like your dogs barking, and we're going to sue you. And we see that happen. And so there's some very real problems. And so as a, you know, as a farmer and as a many libertarians look at these freedom to farm laws and go, right on, we need to stop people from, you know, moving out to the country and harassing the farmers because they want it to be like the city and after all.
Yeah, and the farmers were there first.
They were there first. But what's happened is agribusiness went, ooh, we like this concept.
Yeah.
And they got, actually, there's some variation of a freedom to farm law, I think, in every state. And again, they vary, you know, all over. Texas, I'll use as an example because we're really looking at it closely. But in Texas, if they're complying with the existing law, with any, you know, applicable regulations, and you don't sue them within 1 year, not only can you not sue them, but if you do sue them, you pay attorney's fees. So here, you know, so one of the cases that came up just a few years ago is this woman is sitting, is next to a feedlot. And the feedlot's manure lagoons overflow when there's a rain event.
Mm-hmm.
So she's literally having manure, you know, animal, I won't say it on the radio, running across her property.
Hmm. That sounds like a tort to me.
You think of trespass, nuisance.
Yes.
You know, she sues them, but she didn't bring a suit within 1 year. And so her suit was blocked. This company was able to just literally keep having these manure lagoons overflowing onto her property because, well, they were within the, you know, the permit, the clean water permit that they had.
Well, Congress and I guess probably state legislators are too. They're bought and paid for by the special interests, and the special interest with the most money is the big corporations. And in the agriculture business, it'd be the big agribusiness. So I think you're going to, it seems to me the system is so rigged, it's going to be really tough to beat that. As long as these unconstitutional laws are passed that differentiate and that give subsidies to the big boys and waivers and that sort of thing. I think you just have a tough row to hoe, so to speak.
Well, and it is tough. I mean, believe me, after, you know, I didn't understand. When I founded FARFA, I was like, oh, yeah, I'm going to take a six-month leave of absence from my law job, and then I'm going to go back, and somebody else can do this. That was, you know, 6.5 years ago. But, and so it's a tough job, and there's a huge amount of work. But the interesting thing is not all of the legislators are bought and paid for. You have, I think, three categories of legislators.
Okay. Well, I can think of Ron Paul.
Ron Paul. It doesn't have to be that dramatic.
All right.
You know, they're the ones that are bought and paid for, you know, right. and God knows we can name those.
Mm-hmm.
There are the ones that do stand on principle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just Ron Paul. And then there's this huge intermediary group that frankly just don't even know what the hell's going on, for the most part, especially on this kind of an issue.
The ignorant majority.
Agriculture, well, I mean, think of agriculture is seen as an issue for farming states or farming communities. You know, mm-hmm. the folks who sit traditionally, both in Congress and in state legislatures, on the ag committees are, you know, the good old boys who come from some very rural districts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's who gets put on ag committee.
Right.
And by the way, that's who big agribusiness will then spend the most money on and,
right.
you know, make sure that they've got them locked up usually.
Right.
But food is not just an issue for somebody who's in an area where there's a bunch of feedlots or a bunch of cornfields. Food is an issue for every single person in this country. And we need, and we're starting to see glimmers of this, you know, the other legislators waking up because their constituents are waking up. I think it's, mm-hmm. you know, it this system only works when people get active in it.
So educating consumers is the key then.
Absolutely. If we educate the consumers and the consumers then go to their legislators and say, what on earth? Why are you letting these people get away with putting, you know, genetically modified foods in my food without my even knowing about it? You know, how could you let this happen? Why are you giving my money to these big companies and letting them get away with, you know, polluting things? Why are you doing this? Why are you doing that? And push their legislators, and all of a sudden, hopefully, you know, or gradually, if not all of a sudden, we get more legislators who are not necessarily on these ag committees, but who vote, going, okay, wait a second, I want some answers. My constituents are demanding answers, so I need some answers too. And we see that starting to happen.
Terrific. So there's hope. We're talking with Judith McGreary. She's the executive director of the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance. The phone number here is 847-931-1410. That's 931-1410. Have any questions, comments, observations, give us a call, and we will be back after a few messages.
We reduce children to their lowest common denominator.
57% of us are functionally illiterate.
For us, excellence is a thing of the past.
We killed the teachers and students at Columbine.
We are all trained to follow orders good.
We have learned to be tolerant of all people, except whites, Christians, and males.
27% of us are put on drugs.
The rest of us take the illegal ones. Two-thirds of us believe that from each according to his ability to each according to his need is part of the preamble to the U.S. Constitution.
7 out of 10 of us don't know either of the senators in our state.
We just placed 19 out of 21 countries on math scores, ahead of the Ivory Coast and Sri Lanka.
We elected
George W. Bush
as president
and re-elected him.
And 9 out of 10 of us are products of the public schools.
This message paid for by the Illinois Indoctrinators Association.
Hello friends, this is Kenneth John, and Freedom Rings need your help. I would like to get back to a two-hour show, but that costs money. You can help by contributing to the Heartland Institute, Illinois' own libertarian think tank, with a tax-deductible contribution. The Heartland Institute is an independent, nonprofit research organization in operation for 17 years. Joseph Bast, Heartland's president, is a frequent guest on this program. 90% of what you contribute to Heartland comes back to Freedom Rings to pay for this ad. By contributing $25 or more, you will receive monthly publications including School Reform News, Environment and Climate News, and The Heartlander, the Heartland Institute's monthly newsletter. So please call 312-377-4000 to contribute and be sure to mention Freedom Rings. That's 312-377-4000. Or you can contribute by credit card on the internet by going to Heartland's website at heartland.org. Again, remember to mention Freedom Rings, and thank you for your support.
Ever think that you should be getting more out of your computer? Maybe you need a go-to tech guy. A go-to tech guy is somebody who knows computers inside and out and can help you with yours. John Spazieri is a real go-to tech guy. John Spazieri is a 20-year tech veteran who can help you get more out of your computer. Need software installed and configured? Call John. Want to learn word processing or Excel spreadsheets? Call John. John Spazieri comes to your home, works with you one-on-one on your machine, and shows you step-by-step how to do things you've always wanted to do with your computer. Want to upgrade your computer? Call John. Need to build a wireless network? Call John. Call John Spazieri at area code 630-858-6933. That's 630-858-6933. John Spazieri. Make him your go-to tech guy.
All right, we are back with Freedom Rings, talking with Judith McGreary, Executive Director of Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance. What do you say we go to the phones, Judith?
Sounds great.
All right, we have Jeff. Hey, Jeff, how you doing?
All right, how are you guys doing today?
It's a beautiful day out there, except for when you brought up all this stuff. Hey, I was wondering, a couple of comments and a question. One thing is, I grew up in California, and I used to see, and even to this day, I used to see the INS trucks out in the orchard. I was close to Ventura County, where there's a lot of orange and lemon, you know, citrus orchards. I think you should chase the illegals out on a constant basis. You don't see that anymore. When I used to go up north in the Central Valley, used to see the same thing. They're not doing it anymore. Second thing is, the white Caucasian male doesn't want to dig trees. I have experience trying to hire people. Anything that has to do with physical labor, and I'll argue to them blue in the face with people, because I've had to hire in a stack of 300 applications, I'd be lucky if I get two Caucasians on there. So here's what my comment is, okay? Unless or until that attitude change happens, I don't see the white guy going and digging holes for minimum wage, which most of these, by the way, these landscapers do the same thing. Most guys don't want to dig holes for trees.
I suggest, what's your point? We need the illegals? Is that your point?
Yeah, I'd say the illegals in this country are basically, or maybe they're not illegal, let's just say low-wage earners are going to keep that price down. If you start making it harder for that illegal to work that job, prices will go up. Now, I've always bought, or most of the time, a lot of my farm goods from the local farms out where I'm at. Part of the problem is, and this is, it goes into the stores, is that if you read the labels on a lot of this stuff or see where some of the produce comes from, people would be shocked at how much, but nobody reads it because they'd rather go the cheaper version. You know, it's educating the public like you're doing and telling them what the situation is.
All right, well, you brought up a few points. Let Judith respond to the first, the legal immigration are the ones who do the hard work.
Well, I mean, first of all, I mean, I don't see it's a racial issue. I think it's a fair wages issue. Regardless of who someone is or where they come from, they should get paid a fair wage for their labor.
What is fair? Isn't the market, shouldn't the marketplace
determine
what is fair?
Yeah, that's what, I'm not suggesting setting a minimum wage. I'm saying let the market bear it. And if the only way to get someone to work, you know, to get enough workers is to raise what you're offering, well, guess what? You should be paying more. It's a reality. You know, we don't say, geez, let's just race to the bottom you know, it's too expensive to have people get paid for things. Again, I'm not advocating minimum wage. I'm not talking about the government setting it, but I am talking about the market setting it. A lot of the reason that there's a lot of illegal immigration, illegal workers in agriculture, isn't just because of the low wages either. It's because a lot of agribusinesses like using illegal labor because the conditions are so bad and violate so many laws. And I'm not talking about minor details. I'm talking about people getting killed, people getting maimed, you know, in these jobs.
And since they're illegal, they don't have any stand. They feel that they don't have any stand in court.
Exactly. So particularly because this is a problem with the meatpacking plants, because these jobs are very dangerous because of how
fast. You remember Cesar Chavez, right? You remember him years ago?
Yes, he was supposed, I know who Cesar Chavez
guy?
Was.
Yeah, he was supposed to make that all better, and I guess it hasn't changed, so I don't know where...
It hasn't really changed. The other thing is, the interesting thing about agriculture, and again, sort of one of the very hidden costs of agribusiness and what goes on in our system now, is a lot of the reason... Now, there's always been illegal immigration. I mean, that's always existed. But the reason, one of the reasons there's so much now, and there's so much pressure for a lot of people to come up from Latin America and Mexico into the U.S., is because of what our agricultural trade policies have done to their agriculture. So when we put in these so-called free trade agreements and we take our subsidized agriculture and we dump it on them and we use our foreign policy to basically strong-arm other countries into looking at agriculture as a commodity and how do they export things and let's do a big global free trade thing rather than how do we have a domestic agricultural policy, we drive farmers in those countries off their land And they then go to the cities, and guess what? There's no work to be had. Their economies can't support them. And it becomes a huge pressure to that their farmers are driven off their land, and they end up often as illegal immigrants here because they're desperate.
That's an very interesting point. I've never heard anybody make, but it makes a lot of sense.
National Family Farm Coalition is a good group on that kind of an issue. They talk a lot. And when you look at what we've done with free trade agreements, we damage both our own farmers and really the agricultural self-sufficiency all over the world.
Well, I'm glad you're doing what you're doing. Keep up the good work. Ken's always got some great people on there, and you're one of them. So God bless you guys, and I look forward to hearing some more. Thanks.
All right, Jeff. Thanks for your call. Let's move on. We have John. Hey, John.
Hang on. Oh. I'm working on it.
We got it. Hey, John.
Hello. How much input did you have in the Farmageddon film?
Well, I mean, Kristen Canty did an amazing job with it, and you know, she interviewed me for it, and mm-hmm. you know, we would talk every so often. I don't know how to qualify that, but I think the world of Kristen. She did a lot of good work there.
My question, actually the same question I had for Peter Kennedy, was the farms that were featured in this in the film. It seemed like the government was really coming down heavy on these farms, and I was wondering, is this a widespread thing, or were these people selected by the government for some reason?
Or to make an advantage, example
exactly.
of. Or...
So Kristen chose which farms to speak to, and I mean, I think certainly she chose farms that made that were powerful stories, you know,
right.
that were
sure.
examples of how bad it can get. I think that to differing degrees, that is happening fairly widespread. Now, I don't think that it's common yet, thankfully, for armed government agents to come in with their guns drawn. And, you know, have it pointing in people's faces, which is what we saw in Farmageddon. But the reality is, it's happened. You know, it's what we saw, you know, as she relayed in Farmageddon. And there are lower degrees of that sort of thing happening. You know,
and they only have to do
harassment.
They only have to do that once or twice. And then, you know, most people are just going to say, oh, okay, whatever you say, massa.
People get scared. People go underground. It's a very effective way, unfortunately, to prevent a movement from growing. Because
right.
you intimidate a few people and the fear spreads. And so I do think, I mean, I don't, even though, yes, they were sort of very specific examples, I think that they are symptomatic. I mean, what Kristen portrayed in that movie is the path that we're on and what's going on and why farmers are scared and why people are, you know, treating raw milk like it's a drug deal. I mean, that's really common, regardless almost of what state you're in, except for the few states where it's retail sales allowed. And I checked actually during one of the breaks, Illinois is like Texas and allows on-farm sales. But, you know, it's difficult for people to drive to the farm every week. You know, that depending on where they are and where the farms are, that can be a major hassle. So, you know, a lot of people, you know, I'll meet you in the parking lot and exchange, you know, the white stuff for money. It's absurd. You know, and that's widespread. I mean, that sort of thing, that sort of sentiment that we have to stay underground, we have to stay below the radar, better not let anyone catch us doing something this, you know, revolutionary, that's definitely widespread.
And as you say, it's probably for a lot of people, the regulations could be death of a thousand small, tiny cuts versus,
exactly.
you know, the SWAT team coming in.
It's death by a thousand paper cuts.
Right. John, yeah. anything else?
Yes, I have. Does your organization deal with the legislatures as well as Congress?
What we do is we're not big enough to be literally in the legislature in every state. We provide support for people in different states. So, for instance, if someone's interested in working on a raw milk bill or a cottage foods bill or whatever it is in their state, they can contact us and we can help them, you know, work through proposed bill language, talk about strategy, provide backup materials, you know, help with action alerts and sort of grassroots support. You know, so that's how we function in different states.
How would one go about contacting it?
So for our website is farmandranchfreedom.org, and people can get some info there. To contact me directly, my email is Judith, J-U-D-I-T-H, at farmandranchfreedom.org.
Thank you.
All right, very good. Thanks for your call, John. Mm-hmm. Now, I did find one thing, point on your website. I was a little. I mean, and I'm a supporter of what you're doing, but a little disturbed of what you're asking for. And I can fully understand your position as an advocacy group. And you have to say like support Ron Paul's bill on raw milk. No problem. That's great. Then right underneath it is support the bill that would restrict big agribusiness from engaging in both, I guess, ranching and operating slaughterhouses, that sort of thing. Isn't that a restraint of trade? I mean, if we want freedom, don't we have to have freedom for even big agribusiness?
It's a really difficult question, and you're asking a question that we've struggled with a lot. The thing I keep coming back to is if we were starting at ground zero 100 years ago,
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be asking for what we're asking. What we've got right now, specifically in the context of the meat packers, is we've got four companies that control something like 85% of the meat supply.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a functioning free market.
Right.
You know, free markets depend on a lot of conditions, actually. I mean, a free market depends on good flow of information, active competition, things like that. And so it's a tough line, and I'm not trying to – I mean, this is certainly a place where good folks disagree,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where I'm coming from. I'm coming from looking at this as we don't have a functioning free market. We have producers who, you know, they can't compete, not because of what they're doing, not because they can't compete in terms of they aren't producing a good product at a fair price,
mm-hmm.
but because there's no market. It was interesting listening to Congress, the House Ag Committee debate some provisions in the Farm Bill earlier last week. There was a woman who got up there, one of the Congresswomen, I'm not sure, I think from Georgia, I'm not positive, who was saying that she wanted, you know, to include an amendment to provide for whole business insurance for farmers. And the example she was using was that when one of the large poultry integrators went out of business in her area, there was literally no one the farmers could sell to. You had farmers left with tens of thousands of chickens and no ability at all
because of the restrictions, the regulatory restrictions?
No, because of the market. The market is so concentrated. There's only one
uh-huh.
buyer in that whole region. There was only one buyer. And when that buyer went out of business, literally, they were left with chickens and no slaughterhouse capacity, no way to get it to market. And her answer was, let's create insurance to protect against this. My answer is, well, we need to look into why there's only one freaking buyer.
Well, that was my question. That's what begs the question is, how do we get this way where there's such a concentration in the marketplace?
There are a couple of different things. One side of it is the regulations, definitely. They put in some regulations on slaughterhouses back in the 1990s. That drove a lot of small slaughterhouses out of business.
Hmm.
And one thing we really want to do is see that change. I mean, that's one of the issues I keep trying to work on. So far, we haven't had anyone willing to step forward and do a bill on that. You know, so we're working on educating people on that issue, but so far we haven't gotten to where
was that because of a mad cow disease scare or E. coli or
that was in the name of food safety, the E. coli type issues. And they put in something called HACCP, Hazard Analysis and Critical Control Point Plans,
mm-hmm.
which some of the old-time inspectors also say have a cup of coffee and pray, because basically it's a review of paperwork. The inspector now goes and looks at the paperwork and sips his coffee, and it doesn't improve food safety, but it creates an amazing stack of red tape and paper that buried the small-scale slaughterhouses.
I used to order a really good country ham from Ozarks, Arkansas Ozarks, and it was probably already 10, 15 years ago. Again, maybe it was the late 90s where the regulations changed. They said they just won't ship their hams anymore
mm-hmm.
because. And again, this is a small time operation. relative to agribusiness. But they, it was just the costs were the regulatory costs were prohibitive for them to ship their hams anymore. And
yeah.
I can see how, you know, that goes on, you know, in thousands of different instances throughout the country. And yeah, what the regulations does is it restrains trade and it keeps the big guys big, and the little guys are knocked out. Maybe a bill that would exempt, and they have this in various professions and trades, I think, where if you're operating under a certain ceiling, as far as you know, revenue, gross revenue or whatever, that you'd be exempt from those types of regulations.
And I would love, you know, and honestly, I don't see small scale, I don't see meat processing ever being completely exempt from all regulation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just, it's too high risk of an area for that to happen, I think.
Right.
But certainly reduce, you know, sort of going, if you're under this ceiling, you know, if you're under, you know, often we talk about small scale slaughterhouses being under 25 employees, you know, that it's a different set of regulations. It's an easier set of regulations. And it's a set of I'd want to see regulations that focus on actual substantive results. Like, here's the standards you have to meet, not here's how the bathroom has to be laid out in the facility. And if you don't have a separate hand washing facility right here, and if you don't do, you know, so many of the regulations are things that are infrastructure. You know, you need to have X, Y, and Z, regardless of whether, frankly, you need it in the context of what you're doing.
No, that makes sense. If you're going to have regulations, make them result-oriented and not just try to micromanage every little aspect of things. I remember Mother Teresa wanted to provide, like, a homeless shelter or something in New York City, and it didn't meet the requirements for elevators or whatever. And she said, well, we're going to physically carry these people up the stairs. We're hardworking nuns, whatever, but that didn't satisfy the New York regulators, unfortunately.
Yeah, and that's, you know, so many of the regulations are about micromanaging. I mean, it's an insanely, you know, you look at, you know, regulations on how to do on-farm poultry processing, and it'll tell you literally, you know, what kind of floor, what kind of walls, you know, bathrooms, sinks. And you look at it, particularly for small scale, and you're like, well, there's a bathroom in the house.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like we're bringing in 1,000 outside workers. It's going to be the family and maybe, you know,
right,
two other people. And if someone needs to go to the bathroom, they go to the house and they use the bathroom. No, that's not allowed.
No.
You have to build a whole facility, you know, sanitary facility.
Not in the land of the free. We're talking with Judy McGreary, Executive Director of Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance. We'll be back after a few messages.
I consider trial by jury as the only anchor yet imagined by man by which a government can be held to the principles of its constitution. So said Thomas Jefferson. What does this mean? Nothing less than that a juror has more power in a particular case than a judge, congressman, or president, and can judge the law. A juror has the right and power to nullify unjust law by voting not guilty, contrary to the jury instructions that many judges routinely give that jurors must apply the law as given by the judge. This is a very important check on the power of oppressive government. In the past, jury nullification has asserted its historical importance concerning fugitive slave laws of the 1850s, prohibition in the 1920s, and draft cases in the 1960s. Oppressive gun laws, tax laws, and drug laws are other instances where the people through its jury said no to government. For more information, call the Illinois Fully Informed Jury Association at 847-426-1974. That's 847-426-1974.
Are you politically homeless? Are you tired of being taxed and regulated by the Democrats? Or regulated and taxed by the Republicans? Would you like to pursue your own dreams without the interference of government? Well, then America's most successful upcoming party, the Libertarian Party, is your political home. The Fox Valley Libertarian Party is your local libertarian group working hard to restore the freedoms of our country once held dear. Yes, you can fight City Hall and win. We did. Find out how. With your help, we will make the 21st century the century of liberty for all. We hold monthly meetings at Diamond Jim's Gas Grill, 325 Meyer Avenue in East Dundee, at the corner of Meyer and Barrington Avenues, on the last Wednesday of every month at 7 p.m. Call 847-426-1974 for more information. That's 847-426-1974. Eternal vigilance is the price of liberty.
Okay, Judith, one more time, what is your website?
It is farmandranchfreedom.org, and that's all spelled out.
Very good. Thank you very much for being our guest today. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on.
All righty. All right, quotation of the week. This is from Robert Lefevre. The professional politician has precisely the same personal motivation as the early hunter, forager, or marauder. He is personally involved with making gains and preventing losses for himself, but he conducts his affairs within a structure which disregards the common nature of man and creates instead a class culture in which some men have authority over other men, hence power over other men. This political structure is invariably based upon the ability of some to exploit others to their own advantage by force or the threat of force.
The preceding paid program sponsored by Prairie Fire Communications.
This is the-